I'm really delighted to introduce our first speaker, Dr. Juan Rojas. Juan has many titles at Rush. He was a faculty at the University of Chicago and moved over to Rush. And he's a pulmonary critical care physician, but he's also one of the people that's directing the informatics program there. And he's nationally and internationally known for his work in data science, critical care, quality improvement, and he's really doing amazing work right now in artificial intelligence in medicine through the Scottsdale Institute. And he's really very tight network with all the leaders in the field. So we're so honored that he's not only our scientific session chairperson, but he's the kickoff person to do the first talk today. And I'm going to invite Juan up here and give him a big round of applause to start it off.
Yeah, thank you, Mel, for the invitation, and thank you all for being here at 8 in the morning on a Friday. Hopefully we'll kick off a wonderful conference where people, you know, get to learn about AI, what we're doing with it in medicine, and the earliest phases, I think, of that journey. And I'll be talking today about, I guess, the best topic to start on at 8 o'clock in the morning, AI specifically in pulmonary medicine, and sort of what the literature has sort of shown over the last, you know, 12 to 15 months in this space. I have no relevant disclosures, and we're going to kind of move forward to the talk. The way I think about it is AI in pulmonary is sort of mirrors AI in pretty much every other field, right? So these are just some examples, but not all the examples that are relevant, right? So things like chest imaging and deep learning, early disease detection and screening, so things like COPD, asthma, interstitial lung disease, pulmonary function tests, and how do we liberate, kind of democratize a skill set that historically has been in the hands of maybe a pulmonologist to read those tests. Now with AI, potentially, could we upskill other people in primary care, nurses, nurse practitioners, to get that skill? And then I think the next thing is really just thinking about the sort of era of personalized medicine where we can take a variety of data points and sort of make a precise treatment option for a patient, and then monitoring disease and progression over time. So some of the papers we're going to review today are kind of all across the gamut in this space, and so hopefully we'll spend the next 35, 40 minutes talking about those. So what you'll notice is sort of patterns across these conditions are really kind of four things I'll distill down in sort of AI in pulmonary. Increasingly, AI in pulmonary is more multimodal. Different types of data are being used to predict outcomes or events for patients. We are trying to use AI, or many pulmonologists are trying to use AI to sort of democratize skills that have historically been pulmonary driven to enable other physicians or other allied health professionals to do things. Increasingly, not this is sort of a theme across a lot of specialties, interpretability, especially for traditional machine learning and deep learning, is still important because ultimately almost all AI solutions currently have a human in the loop, right? So someone has to take an AI suggestion or nudge, process that in their brain and say, do I trust it or not? And right, having a sense of interpretability, explainability is important, I think, and still something that is relevant in today's AI landscape. And that I will say phenotyping is becoming more and more important where, we're realizing diseases like COPD are not just one thing. And so if you could sort of think of COPD as a big target, there are sub-targets that potentially may have different treatments or options that AI may be able to unlock, so phenotyping. So the first paper we're going to talk about, it was published this year in the New England Journal of AI, and this is entitled AI-Assisted Spirometry, Interpretation in Primary Care, a Randomized Controlled Trial. What I really like about this paper pragmatically is it's two things. One, upskilling people to potentially interpret or have an assistant to interpret spirometry at the point of care. And two, more importantly, what we haven't done a lot of in traditional healthcare AI projects is actually go from idea, model in real life. And this is one of those things where they actually took something that they built and actually studied the impact on real-life people in real-life clinical settings. And so that's increasingly important, and I think a theme I hope we'll see over the next 2 days at this conference is that that really is the next frontier, in my opinion, for AI-based clinical decision support, is actually seeing if you deploy it in real life, do clinicians find value in using it? Okay, so we'll sort of see some evidence here. So what they did was essentially take people who had spirometry done in an ambulatory setting in the UK, and they had about 133 patients who had spirometry done, 133 primary care clinicians, so that's the unit of analysis here, that were randomized to get AI from the 234 they sort of selected. And the idea, the task here was really for 50 real-world spirometry results to be interpreted by either a clinician without AI or with AI. And then the idea was then to sort of think about the percent of correct diagnoses or predictions made by, you know, if you had AI in the room. And so what the model behind this is sort of a twofold model. One was a model that essentially was a neural network deep learning tool that was trained on a bunch of U.S. data that really helped the model understand, is the spirometry enough of good enough quality to actually interpret. So that's step one. For those of you who have ever done spirometry, a lot of patients struggle with doing it. And so having the right result or having the right data is important for the AI to actually make a prediction, because if it's bad spirometry, it's gonna be bad for a human or an AI to help interpret it. So step one was a model that said, okay, this spirometry meets criteria that is interpretable. That's what AI did first. Number two, they built a second model that essentially helped make a decision about what that AI, that good quality spirometry showed, which in this case was taking those the spirometry loops and some patient demographics, and then predicting what the condition or what the interpretation of that spirometry loop is, and maybe potentially even what condition that patient may have, right? So that's something that's important. So it's kind of a twofold AI application. And what they actually looked for was essentially quality, so we just mentioned that, pattern interpretation, the probability estimate of having some disease, so in this case asthma or COPD, and then they also gave a sort of brief interpretation that was AI assisted. And so what they found was in this sort of small pilot among primary care clinicians in the UK, they found that essentially among a group of users who don't typically interpret spirometry in their professional life, or they do, but maybe not always well, in the primary care setting, so nurse practitioners and GPs in the UK, that having AI assistance based on this sort of two-pronged model did in fact mean that AI was better at helping them make the correct diagnosis faster. Which is good. That's what we want, I think, in patient care, right? And so there was roughly around a 9% improvement in categorizing really any abnormality in spirometry, around a 16% improvement in the diagnosis of COPD, which for those of you who are in the internal medicine space realize that COPD is probably one of the most under and over-diagnosed conditions in medicine, and from both angles, you sort of have people who just get a label, and then some people who have clear COPD who never actually get the confirmatory test, which is spirometry, to get the condition diagnosis. The accuracy was actually better with AI than it was without. So in summary, this paper is sort of a great example to kick off today's talk of sort of taking AI that was trained traditionally, deep learning models that have a specific task, right? Deep learning is, traditional ML and deep learning is always task-based. They do one thing really well. It's not like a foundation model that we're using now on our phone, but they do that thing very well. And those, they put two together and then actually were able to help primary care clinicians make better, faster diagnoses with spirometry, which is, I think, a value add. So we'll sort of see if this is able to scale. That's sort of the next step, is like scaling it from a small pilot to potentially more sites across the UK. So the next one we're going to sort of segue, still keeping in spirometry, because that's pretty much pulmonary's sort of like EKG, if you will. It's sort of the home base of a lot of what we do in pulmonary medicine. And this paper is really going to be focusing on deep learning for detecting early COPD from the spirogram itself. So As you'll see here, and I'll explain why this is important, COPD really is, as I just mentioned a moment ago, very common, very prevalent. It's, you know, 50 to 70% of the time it's underdiagnosed. We're talking about 300 or 400 million cases globally, you know, across the world. With a traditional approach, we're often detecting COPD with just symptoms and then having someone get spirometry a year or 2 or 3 years into their symptoms. And so the idea is, can AI potentially help us think about finding those patients earlier in that trajectory, where even patients who haven't quite developed airflow obstruction, we can predict if you have risk factors like you smoke and you're aging, can we predict if you're going to get COPD a year from now, 3 years from now, etc. And so the scope here was essentially, again, in the UK, where they took a look at this UK biobank data. That's a bunch of European patients who have a series of demographic information and have spirometry, and they sort of trained a model to try to detect early COPD. And they actually trained four models, and they all have cute names, Spiro Smoother, Spiro Encoder, Spiro Explainer, and Spiro Predictor. And what they all do, as you're noticing as a theme, is this idea of ensemble machine learning. So all of these different models have a specific task. So one might be normalizing spirometry data. The next one might be actually predicting the likelihood of COPD. They're all working together in sort of unison to help make a decision of if there is a potential early COPD detection. But any one of these models can't do it. And so that's why a lot of these papers we're going to talk about, not just in my talk, but I suspect in the other talks moving forward, are going to take this approach. And so with this sort of four-pronged approach, what they were able to find was a couple things. But before I do that, one thing you're going to see a lot of in pretty much every traditional machine learning, deep learning talk you ever see and or read are one of these three test characteristics. So for those of you who don't read these papers often, I just quickly wanted to go over that as sort of a side tangent. So the first thing is sort of AUC. So can you, that's probably the most commonly reported test characteristic that is reported in most machine learning papers in the medical literature. And that really is the sort of this idea of discrimination. Can you discriminate who has a condition or not? I mean, that's simplistically what we're trying to report. The higher the number, like an AUC of 1, the better your model is. AUC of 0.5 is literally a coin flip. Does not help you make a decision. The next number that's important that is often not reported often, but I think is important to report, is something called the area under the precision recall curve, or the, you know, some people call it precision recall curve instead of AUPRC. And this is an important metric for especially for conditions in healthcare that are not highly prevalent, right? So COPD, if you look at it nationally and internationally, probably has a prevalence rate of around 3 to 5%. So not everyone in the community has COPD. So for a model to be helpful, making sure that it's actually able to find those rare patients who have COPD is actually important. So oftentimes, even if a model is really good at discriminating and finding kind of those patients who have it, you may have a lot of false positives along the way. And so this is one way of sort of maybe sort of seeing where the model performs in that continuum of, like, is this going to annoy me for every 13 alerts, am I going to find one COPD patient? Or for every 28 alerts, am I going to find one COPD patient? And that's important because that, from a pragmatic, how am I going to actually turn this on and change clinical practice, is important. And then the last one, which is a little bit less commonly used but is reported in this paper that I wanted to highlight, is the F1 score. And so in this one, it's essentially a blended score of a variety of things that I just mentioned. Pretty much it's like if you put AUC and AUPRC together, it's sort of like if they had a baby, it's the F1 score. Oftentimes this one is used, I would say, traditionally by data scientists in the machine learning world as sort of the gold standard for what they're reporting in many of their papers. I have found it less commonly used in sort of the traditional healthcare setting for test characteristics, but it is something that you will see. Any one of these are essentially a way where the higher the score for any one of these, the better the model in retrospective data. And so what they did for this specific tool was essentially, like I said, took some input data, which was basic demographics, the spirometry data, and then did two things. One, make a decision on whether or not COPD was present, like it's you have it. And then also, probably more importantly, if it's not present, when might you get it? So, you know, predicting future likelihood down the line. And so what they found was here, essentially, that that the model actually performed, this sort of two-prong model performed better than sort of an off-the-shelf AI tool called ResNet. That's a model that essentially does a lot of basic imaging processing. It's not tuned to COPD. It's not specifically to COPD. It's sort of an imaging processing deep learning tool. And what they found is this sort of bespoke COPD-specific tool did perform better off the shelf, not amazingly so. Like, we're talking 83 to 82%, so an absolute increase of like 1% increase in AUC or AUP or C or F1. But it did statistically outperform the traditional kind of off-the-shelf model for interpreting FEV1 and FEC ratios across all age groups. And what I think is important is, even though the absolute differences are maybe not that clinically significant, this is a good example of, you know, when can you think about a score helping you do something at the bedside, right? This is ultimately what we think AI's potential is to help us augment our decision making when we're caring for patients in the clinic or in the hospital. And one thing here, when they sort of did a post-hoc analysis in this paper, that the high-risk patients, as determined by this model, had a 5 times higher incidence of getting COPD over the next 5 years, whereas if you were a low-risk patient based on this model, you only had a 2% chance of developing COPD in the next, same time period, next 5 years. So it was able to discriminate fairly well those high risk and low risk. Where it didn't do as well was sort of in that middle ground. And so that's, you know, oftentimes, you know, it's helpful to at least know if you fall on either side of that coin, you can inform your patient, hey, this is probably not going to develop COPD. So say it's a smoker who is just quit, and we are able to get something like this to report to them. It could be kind of really reinforcing your behavior. Like, if you quit now, there's a great potential that you might not get it based on this machine learning tool. Doesn't mean it's for sure going to happen, but at least it might encourage them to stop smoking and durably stop smoking. So a couple things here. I would say this is, like I just mentioned, really the next frontier in COPD prognostication is sort of thinking about using kind of spirometry plus patient demographics to predict the likelihood of COPD and or progression to COPD. Some key limitations here, like I mentioned throughout, this population is heavily European, probably not representative of the vast majority of the United States, so take that with a grain of salt. With a lot of things in AI, the question is if it works in hospital A, is it gonna work in hospital B? This is the same sort of, it's gonna work in Europe, is it gonna work in the US? I don't know. The implementation for something like this, probably in real life, in most modern-day healthcare systems, would be very difficult. Integrating spirometry with patient-level data, using things like HL7 and FHIR, and then a modern IT system in a hospital, it could be practically difficult. Doesn't mean it's impossible, but it could be practically difficult. But I do think this is a pathway. The more projects we have like this in pulmonary and other diseases, it is a pathway to make that argument to hospital IT, hospital operations, that this is worth investing in. So we're going to move on to a whole different condition, interstitial lung disease. So this is a paper also published, this one is a little older, I think 2023-24 time period, where they used AI to help prognosticate and sort of mimic what we do in clinical practice for people with ILD, which I'll explain here in a moment. So ILD, from a clinical challenge point of view, really is difficult because it's a very relatively rare condition. The label of ILD is also very important. The way you label that condition with the final type of ILD informs the prognosis and the treatment for that patient, right? And so that's really important. In the last 5 to 10 years, what's really been important is this whole idea of a multidisciplinary conference where a radiologist, a pulmonologist, sometimes a pathologist, maybe even a rheumatologist, you all get together once a week and discuss cases, and at the end of it, you say that John has ILD and it's IPF. That's what he has. And that is sort of the gold standard now. And so the idea is, from this project, could they sort of have a, what you could think of as an AI multidisciplinary conference type assistant? If you could think of it like that, where they were able to use, again, data. In this case, this is US-based data from Mount Sinai, but it's sort of across the country, around 1,800 or so CT scans. And the idea was, could they predict the type of ILD the person has based on the that adjudicated label that we talked about in that little conference, and also the kind of prognosis of that patient as early as possible. And so this is sort of the framework that they used. It was this idea of CT scans that get cut up into slices. You have images, those go into a neural network model. You also have patient level data that goes into a multi-layer deep learning model as well. So tabular patient data with imaging data, and then essentially train a model that then can predict the label that we give them in that conference. These are kind of more pulmonary words, but things like UIP, usual interstitial pneumonia, is sort of the classic radiographic pattern for IPF, for example. People who have sarcoid also have a specific pattern on CT, so that's one of the labels. There's also something called hypersensitivity to pneumonitis. All these things are things that aren't really relevant to today's AI talk, but the key point here was that AI was trained to hopefully find those patterns that might be predictive of that specific condition that we would adjudicate at the end of that multidisciplinary rounds, and to sort of help be assistant to sort of figure out which one is, which from disease A and disease B, which one's more likely. And then on top of that, the second model was there intended to say, okay, now you have ILD, and we know we think you have this condition. What's your likelihood of survival? That's sort of step two, okay? And so what they essentially did was take that CT scans I just showed you, and then they essentially split it up into a variety of data sets that usually are sort of the usual way you do this, sort of a train test type approach. And like I said before, the success characteristics that they reported are AUC, like we mentioned, discrimination, sensitivity, and specificity. And then sort of the gold standard were 7 human experts that were radiologists and pulmonologists. That was sort of like the source of truth for this specific data set. And so what they found was essentially that for UIP, which is sort of probably the most common radiographic picture that we see as pulmonologists, the AI-based tool, which you can see here.
Recording in progress.
Oh, well, okay. It got excited about ILD. All right. So what you can see up here on the top left, which is sort of this purple bar, that is the AI model, and that's sort of comparing it to a variety of different radiologists. And what you can see is that you can see that the ability for it to be more specific and sensitive was higher for the AI tool compared to human-trained radiologists. For this specific type of ILD or IPF picture, it was a little less good for some of the other conditions like chronic hypersensitivity pneumonitis, sarcoidosis, but still always performed as good or almost as good as the human-trained radiologists and pulmonologists. What it didn't do as well, which is still an area for improvement, is when you ask the model how well could you prognosticate someone's survival, it had an AUC of 0.6 in that very first year. Like, how well are they going to do in that first year to prognosticate for the next 2 or 3 years moving forward? It didn't do that well. Whereas if you gave the model more time, year 2, year 3, it was able to prognosticate mortality risk better. How helpful is that to wait 2 or 3 years to tell a patient, hey, your likelihood of having progression of your disease and unfortunately succumbing at year 3 probably isn't all that helpful clinically. So I think we have to do more there on the AI side, but that's an area for improvement, I think, moving forward. So clinical implementations for this specific study, I think it sort of shows that in a pretty rare condition that has a need for specialized teams, AI can help, right? So that's sort of the idea, I think, behind this paper. And a lot of the themes around my talk, right, is that it's a way of democratizing skill sets that potentially not every referral center or every clinic has. For example, in the current state, if you're a community pulmonologist in the middle of Iowa right now, you do not have access often to a full multidisciplinary conference that has all the different specialists who have ILD expertise. This could be one way to help you diagnose your patients correctly with AI's help, and then maybe refer them to an ILD center moving forward, right? This is one way of democratizing that type of skill set. And I think the next big thing is sort of in a real world way, how do you actually deploy something like this, not retrospectively, but actually test it where in the future, maybe actually like we saw with the PFT study, embed this in sort of a primary care or kind of community or rural-based pulmonary practice and sort of see how much this adds value to the workflow. No one's really studied that, so I think for something like this, that's the next step. All right. This is sort of, I think, one of my favorites that we're going to go through today. And it's essentially focusing on, again, machine learning, which is a theme of today's, I'm sure, all the talks a lot, where this is actually using air quality, personal air quality monitors and lifestyle data to predict the likelihood of you having a flare of your COPD. What I really liked about this study is it reminds me of what I think the future is. And what I mean by that is, I'm sure, how many of you right now are wearing a wearable? Like, probably, I would imagine, at least half the room is wearing a watch, a ring, something, an Apple Watch. You know, they're all, to some degree, I think increasingly our patients that we care for are wearing some device that does have biometric data. And right now, that data is sort of living in an island, and it is not often connected to our other data. And so what I really liked about this paper is they actually took a really novel idea. I mean, it's very not pragmatic, but it's a great idea to ideate on how we can use this type of data to inform our health. So what they did was essentially realize that, okay, COPD is a challenge. COPD is one of the most expensive and high frequent healthcare utilization for people who have moderate to severe COPD. And if you have an exacerbation, your mortality is quite high in that 30-day period. And the readmission rates from a financial penalty point of view from the CMS criteria, it's still one of the key dingers that hospitals sort of have for readmission for COPD. So there's a lot of reasons why people want to prognosticate which patients do and do not have the likelihood of COPD risk moving forward. What they did here was essentially threefold. They picked a group of patients. So in this case, it was about 100 patients in London. They were split between sort of mild, moderate disease. Most of them had quit smoking already. And then what they did is they actually built a custom-built personal air quality monitor. It's like having a watch that goes around with you. It literally was a watch. That tracks the air quality in your local environment. So what a lot of people have done is saying, okay, well, I live in 123 Main Street. 123 Main Street has this air quality. But what we know is humans, we move around. Like, we don't just stay at often 123 Main Street. We go to, like, Starbucks. We go down the street. And so they were able to sort of take this data that the patient was generating and sort of see what the air quality was locally inside their home, outside their home, and wherever they were able to get air quality that was cycled pretty much every day, and it would sort of send data to the server. And they used that for this AI tool. And then essentially what they were able to do is to predict, using 72 hours of data, predict the likelihood of COPD flare tomorrow. That's sort of the whole idea behind this paper, is they take 72 hours, say, make a prediction. Is tomorrow going to be a bad day where you have a flare of your COPD, yes or no? So they, again, a common theme here is a two-stage approach. What they started with first, which is more kind of, because this is very unique data and sometimes hard to really interpret all the patterns, they use unsupervised machine learning, which, as you guys will hear probably in other talks, is one way of clustering patients. So it's a good way for essentially taking a model to say, this is data, I have labeled it with just what it is. So this is the particulate matter, the ozone, et cetera, age, demographics, et cetera. But there's no label. There's no, like, source of truth. COPD, like, for, in this case, the source of truth would be COPD prediction for flare, like you had a flare. It's just the raw data going into the model. This specific model was a K-means clustering model, one of the more commonly used ones in this space, where essentially it's able to sort of, just like a human brain, take a look at the data and put people in buckets, and often two or three clusters, if we'll call it. And so what they found here was that there was two clear clusters kind of when they gave the data to the model. One was sort of a more mild, moderate COPD cluster, more female. And actually, interestingly, the models picked out if you had an electric stove versus a gas stove. Like 25% of the time, the patients in this cohort had an electric stove, whereas in the cohort two, you had more gas, like substantially more gas in the house because of the gas stove that the model picked up. And then what they did was take those clusters and see if making a machine learning model that predicts the likelihood of flaring tomorrow is different by cluster, or does one model okay, independent of cluster. So essentially that's what they did. Just to give you a sense of how well these clusters clustered, they're pretty different, right? Like these are, each dot represents essentially a patient in this cohort, or a data point in this cohort, I should say, with the patient. You can see there's pretty good separation here between cluster one and cluster two. And so what they found was a couple things. One, they built a bunch of models, regression, tree-based models, which were kind of outside of the scope of this five-minute deck. But essentially, the best model was a random forest tree-based model, which essentially is one of the classic machine learning classifiers that we use, not just in healthcare, but across really every industry, that takes sort of tabular data, like you have age, sex, demographics, FEV1 is 10 liters, and predict an outcome. It uses a series of decision trees to kind of go through breakpoints in either categorical variables or continuous variables. Like it'll break up age at 42, and that's where it breaks. And it could keep on going down a series of trees all the way down to the bottom, where you have a probability of that event. It could be death, it could be readmission, it could be, in this case, COPD flare, okay? And what it found was that a couple things that I think are interesting to highlight, that the AUC or the prediction discrimination was best for mild patients to sort of see if they were gonna have a flare tomorrow. Really highly sensitive and specific, and the AUC was quite good, which suggests that maybe having clusters first and then using models to predict within each cluster might be better than a one-size-fits-all model for all COPD patients. Now, the all model actually did okay. Clinically, the AUC of 0.87 versus 0.9, probably not that big of a difference in real life, but it's hypothesis-generating that if you build models within clusters of conditions, like if you're an island of COPD1 versus COPD2, you might actually get a better machine learning output to predict outcomes for those patients if you cluster them first. So that's sort of an interesting, I think, takeaway. What was also common, which is the hard part of AI in medicine, is that for people who are really sick, people who have severe COPD, it's the hardest to predict. There's so many things going on in that person's life that you may or may not be able to accurately discriminate whether or not that person will go to the hospital tomorrow. No matter what you do, you could have the world's best data. Like in this case, you literally had a wearable with their personal air quality, and you had a reasonable discrimination, but it was not nearly as good as the mild patients. And so this is just another reminder that AI is a tool, but sometimes no matter what you're doing, even if you have like world-class data, you may not always have the best prediction, and it's just one thing helping you out in your tool set, right? It's not perfect, it's just one thing that can help you make a decision at the point of care. One thing that it is something you're going to see a lot that I just wanted to highlight a little bit is something called the Schatt plot. If for this idea that we were talking about earlier, where interpretability, explainability is important, many of these tree-based models allow for that. And what that happens is you're actually able to see a little bit behind the curtains of the black box to say, okay, what did the model anchor on that made you think that this person tomorrow is going to have a COPD flare. So what you can sort of see here is that on the y-axis is sort of the strength. So top is the most important model feature. The bottom is the least important, okay? The x-axis essentially is, as you can see here, the kind of as positive to the right of the center increases the risk of exacerbation versus the left decreases the risk of an exacerbation in this case. And then the width of some of these data points are actually the distribution of that variable. So like how many patients of a certain age were in a bucket. If there's a bunch of 50-year-olds, you're gonna have a wider part of the plot. So this helps you sort of visually see if a feature is causing you to have a higher risk or lower risk of readmission, flare in this case, or readmission or length of stay. So it's one way of visually seeing what a model is sort of telling you. So as clinicians in the room, when you see something like this, you can say, hey, does this make sense clinically? Does this something that jives with my clinical opinion? And if it does, it might actually increase your ability to sort of think, okay, yeah, I'll use this tool. Like it seems reasonable. Now, if there's some things on here that are surprising, it doesn't mean that the model is bad. It just means that it learned something like you didn't know. Like one thing I know, for example, is that in every model I've ever built, RDW, which is a lab that we check all the time, is highly predictive of inpatient clinical deterioration. The reason why, I have no idea. But I can tell you, in every model I've built, it is always important. Same thing with Braden scale, which is sort of more intuitive. A nursing-based assessment for pressure sores and pressure ulcers is always very predictive of inpatient clinical deterioration. So sometimes it surprises you, but I think in general, these are good things that can help you sort of demystify some of the model output. We talked a little bit about this, so in the interest of time, we'll move forward. The next one is focusing on pH, which is, again, another rare condition, but an important, very deadly condition, right? So for those of you who've cared for any pH patient, they always have typically a very short life expectancy, even if they have kind of the better flavor of pH versus the worst. And so having a sense of what type they have, again, like ILD, is really important. In this case, what I think is important is that two things. One, unlike some other pulmonary conditions, the lag from when someone has symptoms to when they're diagnosed with pulmonary hypertension is like somewhere on the average of 2.5 to 4 years. So it's quite a long tail. The test that we often do as a screening test is a heart ultrasound or an echocardiogram, is not terribly good at sort of figuring out if people have pH. The specificity is just around 56-57%, and it has a pretty high false positive rate, meaning there are patients who will look like they have pH on an echo, but then you do a right heart cath, which is the definitive test, and they do not. And so they go through an invasive procedure that doesn't have zero risks associated with it to make that diagnosis. And so what they did here was essentially in a hospital in China, took around 1,500 patients or so that had, 3,500 patients who had a risk of having a high pretest probability for having pulmonary hypertension. They took features like their structure data, like their clinical variables, like demographics, et cetera, their echo report, their EKG and chest x-ray reports, and then their actual chest x-ray images, put all of that into a model, which we'll talk about here in a moment. So this is sort of a schematic of what they did, where they essentially are taking pretty much, again, the theme here is multimodal data, EKGs, chest x-rays, text, and tabular data on the row level to sort of make a prediction. And sort of what they found was that, again, in the prospective use of this tool, that their prognostication of whether or not figure out if someone did or did not have pH using right heart cath data as sort of the gold standard, like we did have it, they were able to discriminate before that right heart cath with an AUC of 0.94, which is pretty good. Like, you were able to know with a pretty good discrimination that based on all the data you have before you make a decision to prescribe that invasive procedure to a patient, that you were able to kind of say the likelihood is quite high that you're going to have it with a good degree of sensitivity and specificity. And if you compare this to an echo, just an echo alone, this sort of multimodal AI approach kind of gave you a 20% improvement in the specificity of that prognostication. So you're able to really have a much higher degree of confidence that if you use a model like this, you could actually decide, okay, whether or not the patient should go ahead for a right heart cath or not, based on more than just an echo and your clinical gestalt. Again, this is sort of a theme today, that multimodal data with something that kind of looks like this, where essentially you take an x-ray, you take reports, you put it together into an AI tool, can help you make a decision at the bedside. And I'll go through with the last one in the interest of time and kind of go through, I think, one of my favorites, because this is more education focused. So like we talked about before, earlier in this talk, the spirometry kind of democratization of that skill set, I think, is really important, right? So, like, how do you take a skill of reading spirometry, interpreting spirometry, that's been around for now 80 years, give or take, more than that, which is great, democratizing that skill. What's a newer thing in medicine, for those of you who practice inpatient medicine, is ultrasound. All of you who work in inpatient care now have an ultrasound machine in your unit somewhere, and even in third world countries, for places that don't have good chest x-rays or radiology, they have a pocket ultrasound. Okay, so like, they're doing things, this is sort of across the gamut, ultrasound has really replaced or augmented point of care clinical decision making. And so this paper that was published in JAMA Cardiology was a great way of sort of showing how could AI help to kind of upskill or teach people lung ultrasound. What we know about lung ultrasound is two things. One, it actually is better at detecting pneumonia and pneumothoraxes compared to chest x-rays in almost every study that people have compared it to. So it's better than what we thought the gold standard has historically been, and lung ultrasound does better for both of those conditions. But the problem with that is that there's kind of this gap, right? The people who are trained sonographers, who are critical care doctors, ER doctors, who can do lung ultrasound and understand lung ultrasound, that number is small, right? So how do you upskill people with an ultrasound who have access to an ultrasound machine but don't have any lung ultrasound experience? And so this whole paper was really focused on that, is how do you take people, in this case they took people who were 176 individuals who had no prior ultrasound experience. So they were just novices who worked in healthcare, but did not have any significant ultrasound experience, and they put them in two groups. One with AI assistance and sort of non-experts with AI assistance, or experts with no AI. That's sort of what they studied. So people who knew what they were doing with an ultrasound, trained, versus those who kind of knew what an ultrasound was, but had AI to help them along the way, and then took a look at whether or not they were able to get the correct image, a diagnosis, and sort of a series of patients who had acute shortness of breath in the ER or in the hospital-based setting. And so what they found was, or what they did first, I guess, is create this AI system. So very briefly, essentially, this AI system did three things. It helped you learn how to use an ultrasound. It helped you get good images when you're holding an ultrasound on the chest, okay? And when you found an image on the chest that was good, it actually would take the image and capture the photo right at the right time. So what happens in ultrasound is you're moving it around, you find a good window, it actually will then capture it right at the right time without you having to do anything. You didn't have to hit a button, it just did it. So it sort of knew that this was the right place at the right time to capture that data. Whereas for the human, the expert, they have to decide that that's a good picture. Okay, so that's the biggest thing this AI did. And this is sort of what it looked like. It sort of was an AI assistant that essentially helped you move your probe around, would give you sort of feedback on where you were, and that it would actually capture what to do and where to do it. And what they found was essentially non-experts with AI guidance, so people who were in healthcare but had no specific ultrasound expertise, were able to get diagnostic quality good images 98% of the time versus experts only 97 or so percent of the time, so as good, non-inferior, which is great. Again, this is the idea of democratizing people with AI upskilling, I think is important. So in the interest of time, I will kind of give you my two cents of where we are now. I think the current state of AI in pulmonary is from proof of concept to clinical readiness. So what I think is working today is we have a lot of AI tools at COPD, asthma, ILD, PH, sleep medicine that are in this idea of transitioning from a model that can then potentially be useful in retrospective data. We haven't seen a lot of prospective use of that tool in real life to see if it actually has made a clinical impact. So I think that's sort of the next frontier for pulmonary medicine, is to transition that sort of retrospective to prospective. And hopefully, I think that'll be a theme probably for many other conditions that we're going to hear about at the conference. So with that, I will let you guys get coffee and take any questions offline or online. No coffee. Coffee after.
Nice, very nice lecture, thank you. I don't think that Medicare, welcome to Medicare exam now includes a spirometer. Do you think the AI data would be robust enough that you could capture enough information to convince Medicare to include it in the welcome to Medicare exam?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I think there's enough, maybe not quite there yet as far as like breadth of data. I think the limitation is really getting the spirometer in the room, which is a whole separate practical, sometimes limitation in some clinics. But I do think that it's a way to potentially incentivize for some of these sort of annual visits to have that as part of what you could think of as preventative or routine care, right? Like we think about a colonoscopy, getting PFTs for someone who has a risk factors for COPD should, in my opinion, be done in primary care. I don't think you have to see a pulmonologist for that. So I think it's maybe, I think, is the honest answer. Anyone else before I step down? If not, thank you so much.
Hey everybody, John here. Thanks for listening to another episode. If you enjoyed what you heard here today, please check us out on our website, www.americancollegeaim.org. Sign up today to become a member. And don't forget to save the dates, October 9th and October 10th, 2026, here in Chicago at McCormick Place Convention Center. We're having our second annual scientific session. Special shout out to everybody who joined us in 2025. You all made it amazing. Thanks so much for coming. We hope to see you all next year. Don't forget to sign up right away. www.americancollegeaim.org. We'll see you then. Bye, guys.